Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to 720 Degree Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton, and today is going to be a real tennis coaches episode. We're going to be covering the worst tennis advice that people get out there, and what's the antidote for that? What are the good practices that are going to help? So, first up is Debbie Klink. And so, hello, Debbie. How are you?
Hi, Bill. I'm fine.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about where you are and what do you do with your tennis coaching?
I'm in the Yucaipa, Cala Mesa area, which is in Southern California, about 70 miles east of Palm Springs and 70 miles, west of Palm Springs, about 70 miles east of L.A. So we're kind of in that, you know, little inland area. What I do with my tennis is work with kids, a lot of kids, beginners, 10 and unders, and then also high school level kids that are also, some of them playing tournaments, some are just high school players. But that's pretty much what I work with.
Terrific. So what is one of the worst advice instances that you see with your players that they get elsewhere?
Well, a lot of it's a misconception about positioning of in doubles play. I'm more talking about the high school girls team. Sometimes with the boys, they're apprehensive of where they stand with a server behind them, and they position themselves sometimes into an alley to where they're not going to get hit, or sometimes they position themselves very close to the net, and trying to teach them where to stand and how to position so there's not a lot of holes and good opportunities for them to maybe put a ball away is what I find
is a lot
of misconception.
All right, so if somebody's standing in the alley, what are the negatives behind that? What does that expose that team to?
Well, what I think it exposes the team to is it basically puts the server into a position of covering about two-thirds of the court while you're maybe maintaining a third over there in the alley. So you're opening up maybe a good gap in the middle of the court that the other player has to cover for you. Possibly lobbing to where you're not in a good position to cover a lob going over.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing I like is when the net person is in their proper position, then the server really only has to think about really either a forehand or a backhand. I don't like to have my server serving and then having to worry about a ball coming up the middle of the court and having to be ready for that. It makes life so much easier on that server if the other player is over a little bit further. So
yeah,
that's
agree.
Great. All right, so Debbie, thank you so much.
Yeah.
I'm going to move on to the next caller, which is okay. Thanks so much. And feel free to call back. We could cover another one, but I have someone waiting right now,
that's
last four digits 3839. So I'm going to be right with you there, caller.
All right. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Debbie.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye bye.
Bye-bye. Hello and welcome to the show. This is Bill. Who am I talking to?
Hey, Bill. It's Dewey out in Italia.
Oh, terrific. Hi, Dewey. How are things?
Good. I had no idea what the show topic was. I just thought I would call in and listen on my ride home. What you thought about?
Okay. Well, that's terrific. Now, you're a little quiet on my end, so if you can do something to bump up your volume, that would be great.
Is this any better?
Yes, much better. Thank you so much. All right, so the topic is the same one that was posted on Real Tennis Coaches, the Facebook page. What's the worst tennis advice that you've heard, and what's the antidote for that?
Worst tennis advice I've heard was to a junior player, someone said, don't listen to your parents.
Okay. And so...
All right. antidote to that is have a greater discussion between everybody as to what it is your parents are actually saying. As a parent in year one also, you know, what would you do if a coach said to your kid, don't listen to your parents? I suspect it would be the last time you wrote a check to that coach.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, though, let me play devil's advocate for a second, because we do know that sometimes parents can be overbearing with their own child, and or they can give poor advice, or they can become a distraction. So then how do you handle that without going all the way towards don't listen to your parents?
Well, I think you have to, first of all, find out where the parent's motivation is and figure out to what degree do they understand the whole process. A parent is the one person you know always wants the best for their kid. I've not ever run across a parent that did anything to hurt their own child purposefully. So you know that their motivation is in the right place. Their experience and education is probably not led them to the place where you want them to be. So you have to figure out, well, how can I fairly bluntly, you know, give them the information that they need, but also recognize at some point it's really up to what the parent believes is best for their child. And we as coaches, we provide a service, and we get to decide what our service is. But it's also the parent's choice as to where they're going to spend their dollars, who they want their child to be involved with and have an influence over their child as they develop. I don't know. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, and now let me follow up a little bit more on that, because recently I've started doing something new with my the first time a kid comes on the court with me is I explain to the kid that there's three different types of people. There's parents, coaches, and players. And I ask them, who's the decision maker? And they say, you are. And I'm like, no, that's wrong. And they say, my parents are. And I say, no, that's wrong. And then their face changes, and they come to this realization that they are the decision maker. And it empowers them. And then I ask them, all right, who's your expert consultant? And they say, that's easy, that's you. And I'm like, okay, good, very good. Then they're stumped by the third question, who gives final approval? And they say, I do. No. You do. No. It's your parents give final approval. So, you know, that's kind of frightening for some parents to hear that their kid is going to be the decision maker. So what thoughts do you have on that stuff?
Well, and I guess at some point in time we hope that they have the necessary information to become the decision maker. And as a parent, I hope that I raise good adults, not that I raise kids that are become super dependent on someone else to make decisions for them. And I view tennis players kind of like a crown prince, you know, that William and his wife had a baby and who will someday be king. But at the moment, you know, has a nanny and all kinds of other people that make decisions for him. And at some point in time, he'll get, you know, they are actually his subjects. And at some point in time, he'll get to decide what they do. But at the moment, not. And obviously, you know, there's a maturation process. And, you know, how much do you empower a 7-year-old to make decisions when they have no experience to base it on? And until you get pretty far down the road, you know, someone, you can look at them and say, well, you've never been any better than you are, so how do you know what it takes to get better than what you are? But then they grow to a place where they recognize, okay, to move from where I was to where I am, it required I come out of my comfort zone, I do things I wasn't very good at, and all of those things. And so I can make the decision as to whether I should be making those same kind of changes at this point in time.
You make great points. And so, I mean, I think the decisions that I like kids under the age of 10 to make is, do they want to pursue greatness? That's the first thing that I ask them is, that, you know, because it's really important psychologically for kids under 10 to have big, dreamy goals. That's healthy. So the first place I start is, how good do you want to be? Do you want to be number one in the world, right? Which, of course, is not, quote, realistic, but it's very healthy. So, and then what we do is we say, well, you know, what? We don't even get into what is that going to take, but we do get into, it means that you're going to have to learn an awful lot. Another example would be that, you know, I'll be working with a kid, they're 7 years old, and I'll ask them, okay, I could teach you a way to serve that would have you serving better earlier, or I can teach you something that when you're older, you'll thank me more because you'll have so much more potential to hit the ball better. And my experience tells me that the kids 90% of the time choose the more difficult technique. So those are some examples of kids' decision-making, you know. So I forgot to ask you go ahead.
I'm sorry, do you believe that in that case they made the decision, or was it guided discovery where you kept the bumpers on pretty close and ensured that they came to that decision?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm fine with both of those because either way, we've created a structure where they know that they're power to make decisions will be growing. So, yeah, you can't account for how much is the player influenced by the adult who's posing the question.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
well,
I know. I think that's a very insightful question. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm good either way, but what I would look for is, as we develop our relationship and the trust, and the kid has develops a more thorough way of thinking things through, then the questions become more challenging, and not that there isn't as much direction pointing going on. Ultimately, then, the goal is that the kid owns their own game.
Certainly the goal. Thanks for giving me a voice. I hope you don't mind if I keep listening in while I continue my drive.
Oh, please do. In fact, tell the listeners where you are and what you're doing with your tennis.
Well, I'm in Dallas, Texas, which is, you know, there's a lot of tennis here, and I run a public facility called Samuel Grand Tennis Center, which is one which has, you know, fairly decent history. It's been around about as long as I have. I've been here 51 years, and it's been here for 50. But it was a place where Arthur Ashe made his Davis Cup debut in 1965, and it had to be held, the Davis Cup tie had to be held at our facility because there was a local country club that said he couldn't use their facilities. So it's a great place, and it's been on a resurgent path over the past 4 years that we've been there, and we're fortunate that we were just notified that we're awarded the 2014 USTA Outstanding Facility Award for facilities over 11 courts. So it's
congratulations.
Well, thank you. It's a verification of, you know, the path that we've taken, and we kind of view it as the end of Act One, and we're going to keep trying to move forward and keep growing and bringing more tennis to the Dallas community.
Terrific. Yeah. All right. So thanks so much for coming on the show, Dewey.
Oh, thanks.
All right, take care. All right, bye. Okay, so I need another caller, but I'll share one. And it really has to do with ground stroking, because a lot of times I hear or I see players who are taking their racket back early. But the problem there is that the tip that they were given was get your racket back, get your racket back, get your racket back. But with no idea in terms of the timing of that. So I think a far better instruction to give someone is to prepare the racket with your shoulders, and then right around the time the ball's bouncing, then take your swing. So, and there's a lot of experience that comes into the timing of that, because sometimes you may initiate your swing slightly before the bounce of the ball because it's coming so fast, and other times you may begin the swing slightly after the bounce of the ball because it's a higher, slower ball or whatnot. So that's it's a much better cue to prepare the racket and keep it where you can see it until such time as you're going to take your complete swing, because the backswing is actually a part of the forward swing. So hoping to get another caller here pretty quick. So if you're listening in right now, give us a jingle here, and that number is, hold on, wait for it. I need to get back to my screen here, and what do we have here? All right, so it's 347. All right, area code 347. Area code 347. And I'm trying to keep talking here while we get another caller. Scrolling down. 347-826-7189. 347-826-7189. And I do need another caller here shortly. So, on ground stroking, yeah, get the racket back. I mean, I think that's one of those old time, that's very old school kind of thing. And I think part of what used to be okay about that was that the rackets were so much stronger. I mean, so much heavier than before. All right. Oh, so it looks like I've got a caller back again. Hello, caller. How are you?
Hey, Bill. It's just me again. I was trying to listen on the phone but not talk. But if you want to just chat, I'm certainly happy to talk about whatever
Okay. It's
on your mind.
No, it's perfect. It's perfect, you know. So it's a free-flowing conversation here. But that's true. I'm glad you're here. And so why don't you throw me another one that is kind of a common thing. And maybe we could focus a little bit on technique.
Okay. It's certainly a controversial subject. You know, one person's technique is somebody else's horror show.
Right.
So technique-wise, what have I heard, which, you know, you were talking about the racket back. That tends to be one of my bugaboos with staff. They all know that if I hear you say racket back, I'm going to walk on the court in the middle of your lesson and probably do something that I would regret at a later point. So I think that, you know, there are a lot of old school type things which don't necessarily, they're still applicable, but the way they're applied needs to be looked at somewhat differently. The whole thing, you know, everybody used to say step into the ball. We're sometimes actually probably rotating neutral and being absorbing is more important rather than always trying to win the collision with the ball. So not always, you know, attacking a ball which you have no business attacking. Let's see, technique-wise.
Well, you know, let me go a little further on what you just said right there, because the ball didn't used to travel as fast, and now ball speeds are up, 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 and spin kicking the ball forward at you is up, 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 and so absolutely, there are so many more neutral and defensive situations in a tennis match than there ever were before, that really the new stepping in is probably just being able to get your weight forward onto your front foot. And that most of the time, stepping in could be just rotating, being able to rotate forward onto a ball. One thing I'm a big fan of is teaching my players three different ways to rotate on a shot. You can rotate on your front foot, which is going to happen 5 to 10% of the time. You can rotate within your core inside the cylinder, which is probably 75 to 80% of the stroking that you'll do when you're rallying. And then the new thing that's happening more and more often is the diagonal backwards move, rotating off of the back foot and turning approximately 150 to almost 180 degrees. So what do you think about those three items?
Well, I think that, you know, my goal is always to get someone to be able to manipulate the ball in such a way that the ball does what they wanted it to do. And that really means it does what has a flight path that they want it to have. It has the effect that they hope it would have on the person at the other end. And so how you create those, you know, it determines the technique. So form following function, someone might say, relative to that. I actually believe the biggest impact on technique has to do with positioning on the court. And so an understanding of what my opponent's options are and then where should I be to be able to be reactive to those and be in the best place. So I think we have still some leftover from the Andre Agassi era of people saying, you know, keep your toes on the baseline. And certainly Jeannie Bouchard having the success that she had is going to have more people saying, okay, here's what's coming in tennis is we're going to stay right on the baseline and we're going to take every ball early. You know, yet you look at Nadal and Djokovic and Federer and Ferrer, you know, the best players in the world, Murray certainly, you know, also play the best defense in the world. And so they're, you know, fully aware of when do they need that extra step. And when have they hurt the other person where the other person's looking for that extra time, and so now it's time to move forward and rob them of that time that they're looking for. So I suspect, and at least in my thinking, that's the great missing piece of everybody's, not everybody, a large number of people are taught, here's your position relative to the baseline, and it doesn't change tactically based on where they are in the phase of play, if they're in an aggressive phase or a neutral phase or a defensive phase. And so they're not looking at what their opponent's options are. And so that causes a lot of that, you know, rotating backwards that you talk about. It was really a function of someone didn't recognize that their opponent could probably hurt them from that position. Consequently, they're not in position relative to the ball in enough time, and so they're having to play a more defensive shot to now try to get back to neutral somehow.
Yeah, and you know, having said that, I mean, there's two things that come out of that. I mean, one, I think part of the genius of both Nadal and Djokovic, the two supreme defensive players right now, they both pull that off quite well and seem to be able to get the ball back deep, so that they're not, you know, they're not still hurt on the next shot. You know, and then in regard to the standing on the baseline, that could be good or not good. You know, I it concerns me when people use a cookie-cutter approach and one size fits all, but for a player who's maybe lacking some foot speed, then playing a little closer is going to be smarter for them in general, because then they reduce the track meet aspect of the match by standing closer and reducing down angles and whatnot. So, you know, it could be sensible for some person based on their game style. So, you know, but yeah, one size doesn't fit all, and you shouldn't force someone into a mold that doesn't fit their abilities.
Yeah, you know, another one for me might be, you know, hold the racket like this, particularly on ground strokes, that there is no single forehand grip, or, you know, I guess there are some limitations of certain grips. And so I always look to say, okay, with that grip, can you do what you want with the ball in this situation? If you can't, or if it's potentially going to cause injury, you know, those would be the two reasons to change, certainly more potential injury than not being able to do something with the ball, because you don't ever want someone to get hurt and not enjoy the sport of tennis. But there are a lot of people that, you know, don't recognize a lot of top pros will look, and they have different grips based on what they want to do with the ball. I was coaching a young man who, he's now going to his sophomore year of college, but at the time he was, I think, 11 years old. He came off the court after playing an indoor 14 and under match on a very fast court against a tall kid with a Western grip. He came off the court and he said, I used my Eastern forehand today because the kid was tall, didn't like to bend. He had a Western grip and the courts were really fast. And I was like, didn't even know you knew that you had different forehands. But his awareness of, okay, I want the ball to be flatter, lower, take advantage of the speed of the court, and so consequently, and that the balls wouldn't bounce as high on his end, was phenomenal, as opposed to him saying what I've seen so many people do of they miss a shot and they take shadow swing, and I look at him and I say, that's exactly the swing that you just took. Unfortunately, the ball wasn't where you just swung.
And you know, that makes me crazy, you know, and I see teenagers do this all the time. I mean, they'll have some horrific problem of poor positioning brought on by lazy footwork, and then they take the practice swing, you know, and so we have to have a little heart-to-heart at that moment. It's like the problem was not your swing. Is that you were completely in the wrong spot to take that ball at the right place, you know? So, yeah, you brought back my pain right there. So,
good. Well, I don't have a lot more, but if you have a couple more, I got about 5 more minutes until the house. So, more than welcome to stay with you.
I'm hoping, I do believe I'm going to have another caller momentarily, but let's do one more. How about this? How about what's some of the worst advice in terms of how people get along socially at a club or a tournament or whatnot?
The worst advice? That's interesting. We had a discussion this past week of, you know, should you be friends with your opponent and how do you treat that? And I think the general consensus was you have to figure out what works best for you. If you worry about whether someone will be your friend if you beat them, then you probably need to not be as friendly, or until you can overcome that sensation, because my thought has always been, you know, well, do you think that they're going to think you're not going to be friends? And when you're walking back up and they're carrying the balls, you know, are they worried about whether you're going to talk to them later? But I'm not sure when we're talking about interpersonal relationships, if there's ever a right way. So I don't know if anybody's really given anybody, as I've watched, anybody give somebody advice on the good or bad. What have you seen?
Well, I want to comment on what you said rather than answer your question that you just gave me, because I myself had trouble beating people that I was friends with. And I think I subconsciously had this thing that that I didn't want to hurt their feelings. I didn't want them to lose. You know, I wanted to show that I could play well, but, you know, so the, what I ended up having to do was become less friendly myself. So I have this, the first time it changed for me was I was playing a friend in the semifinals of a tournament, and he, on the first changeover, he's starting to make small talk with me, and I just had to say, hey, you know what, dude, I like you, but I will talk to you after the match because right now you're my enemy.
Yeah.
And so he was kind of taken aback by that, and I was able to win the match because I was able to shut all that down, all that concern, and that was a big step for me as a player. And then, you know, then afterwards, you know, then we talked it out, and I think he understood after we got done. But it was, I was being a little gruff with the guy. But, yeah, it is an interesting thing. And I think people take it too far when they go to the, when they go to the tournament, and from the moment they arrive at the tournament until they end, until they leave, they seem to have no friends at all. So I would advise people to have some type of social interaction before or after, but then learn how to shut it down in the minutes before your match and turn it right back on shortly after your match is over.
At times in the past, we've gone so far as in a practice situation to come out with a little file card box and a bunch of index cards. And what we did is we told the kids, here, write the names of every one of your friends who's here down on this name, on this index card, and I want you all to put them in the box. And you're taking, and you're putting, essentially putting your friendships in the box. When you walk inside the fence, you are now competitors. And when you walk back out, pull the card back out and essentially, you know, renew the friendship part of it. And those were more on, you know, competitive days, because most of the time we really view it as, you know, because you are friends, you owe it to your, to the other person to give your very best, because they, just like you, want to become good, and so they need you to push them on a day in and day out basis. So being on the court and pushing the other person is actually an act of friendship, not any kind of place where you're antagonistic so much. And it works for some, and it doesn't work so much for others. Just like everything else, it's just another tool that's there, and you hope that it works for the person that you're applying it to. And when it doesn't, you look for another one.
You know, I couldn't agree more with everything you just said. I just think that was spot on, and I think anybody who's listening to this is going to be well advised to consider that tool, you know, with their players. You know, the word competition comes from the Latin root of competere, which means two seeking together. So essentially it's like, hey, we have this friendly agreement that we're going to go out and bash heads to find out who's better today. So competition at its core is cooperation.
I took enough years of Latin, I should know that, and I just, you know, created a company with a friend with a couple of Latin words. So thank you for giving me that piece of information. So thanks.
All right. Hey, thanks so much for calling, Dewey. So, and glad we got you on again. So this is going to be kind of an amusing show here today, I suppose. But have a great Sunday afternoon.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Take care. Bye.
All right, bye. All right, so looking for another caller. I know one post that came up on this, on the Real Tennis Coaches Facebook page, was the concept of scratching your back on the serve. And so that's an interesting one, because I think it was Vic Braden who said it really should be scratch your friend's back. And, you know, it's an interesting thing, because there is a moment when you're serving that the racket will actually drop into a position that would look like you were scratching your back. But the problem is if you intentionally try to drop your racket straight back into that position, it puts a tremendous strain on your elbow and can also create some pretty serious shoulder problems as well. So what I tell my players is to draw their racket back and bring the tip of the racket over to their left shoulder if they're a right-handed player. And then as it circles around and you turn your shoulders, then it comes through from there. A little trickier because people don't intuitively see that the shoulder turn is going to be what brings that racket around. It does take a little, you definitely need some practice to master that and get the feel of it. So, oh, perfect timing. Got another caller here. All right. Hello, caller. Please identify yourself.
This is Chad Barron.
Chad Barron, how are you, sir?
Good. How are you doing, Mr. Patton?
I'm doing fine. So tell the callers where you're from and what do you do with tennis?
I live on the north side of Houston, Texas, near the Woodlands, Conroe area, and I have coached at high school level. I recently took a job, though, at a junior high, and I'm going to develop a little program at a junior high. It's closer to home.
All right. And so what's the worst advice that you've heard?
Oh, I don't know if I can come up with anything original versus what everybody else has probably said, so especially this late in the show. I really can't come up with anything that original, so.
Well, give us something unoriginal and quick.
Unoriginal and quick. You put me on the spot. So I would say that taking the racket back early and running with it way back, you know, in a coiled position. I think that's a misnomer.
Okay, so what would you say about that then? What's the solution? What's the reality?
The reality is that the players keep the rackets in front of them as they're running to where they want to go, and then they start their take back once they slow their feet down into smaller steps to get ready to get on balance and ready to step into the shot.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. And you know, that's absolutely, because you know, we were talking about earlier here is that the backswing is part of the forward swing, and you have so much more easy momentum that you can maintain if you don't get your racket back too early.
Right.
So,
absolutely.
When you're coaching high school tennis and or you know middle school tennis, and you get these kids and they've come from elsewhere, what are some of the things that they do because, you know, either another coach taught them something or maybe their parents taught them something, and then you find yourself correcting that? What's one of those common things besides taking the racket back early?
Oh, here's one. I had a girl who was trained by another quote-unquote pro, and we were in a regional tennis match. And she was getting obliterated. She's my number one. And asked her what her game plan was. And she told me, I'm just going to keep hitting the ball hard. It keeps going out, but I'm just going to keep hitting the ball hard. That's what my coach tells me to do. So that just kills me, you know, when you're in a match.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you have to make, I mean, I understand there's a developmental side to the whole you know, player development, but also when you're playing a match for your team, you know, you have to adjust, you know, to help your team as best you can. When you refuse to adjust, then you're really not being a team player in my mind. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm reflecting on a match where I was coaching a girl and she's kind of a pea shooter. She didn't really have a lot of power in her game, but she's playing the gal who's got the huge forehand, right? So she's trying to avoid the huge forehand, and she's hitting exclusively, almost exclusively to the girl's backhand. But what we did is we were charting the match, and we found that for every winner that the girl hit on her forehand, she made at least three errors. And so, you know, but the winners she hit were scary, you know. So you don't want to hit the ball and then watch it go past you, you know, and sprain your neck. But we,
right.
But we also figured out was that the girl almost never missed her backhand. So my little pea shooter starts going to the girl's forehand and comes from a set and a break down to win in three sets, you know, and everybody thought she was crazy. So, you know, that's the counterexample of being on the other end of the girl who feels like she always has to hit hard, right? You give
right.
up so many errors there. So,
right.
All right. So how about on a doubles court? What do you see on a doubles court? Debbie Klink already shared about kids standing in the alley, but.
In doubles, the thing that kills me is just standing there and watching the ball and watching it go past you and not moving back and forth and, you know, moving with the ball. If it goes past you, moving back. If it, you know, when your partner hits it, you need to move forward and looking to, you know, split step on the opponent's hit, you know, maybe, and then look for something floating across the middle. Too many high school kids don't poach.
Right, and so here's the misconception that speaks to, I'm thinking, is that when you're at the net, then what's active in their mind is that they shouldn't make a mistake, right?
Right.
You got to stay in one place, play it safe, never make a mistake at the net, right? But really the opposite's
right.
true. You have to be kind of a swashbuckler, and you have to be able to take some risks, and you might make one error per game.
Right. I totally agree with that.
So, all right. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you want to be very active up there and make things happen. And, you know, another thing, too, is that, you know, I think there's also another misconception that goes with that, and it feeds into the other one. And that's that the server is responsible for holding their own serve. And so if the net person's making a mistake, then the server's kind of out of control. When really, then servers can sometimes shame their net person. You know, if the net person makes an error, then the server might give body language or might even say something like, hey, don't do that again. And they're actually shooting themselves in the foot.
Right.
So I like to have my server go to the net person after they've missed and say, hey, don't worry about it, and stay aggressive up there, because the more unpredictable you are up there, the more valuable you are to me, because then you make it so much tougher for the returner to feel any kind of comfort level as to where they can return to.
Right,
so.
and one of my pet peeves in doubles is the kids not communicating with each other. You know, they're a team, but they won't say five words to each other in between points. But when they come off the court, they chit chat, and it's like, you know, that's what you got to have during the match, where you're, you know, you're talking to each other, you're keeping each other pumped up and focused, and not worrying about mistakes, helping each other stay, you know, ready for the next point.
Yeah. You know, and it's that's another great point, too, is to, even just the appearance of being together on the court and just a word here or there. So what I do is I get my players together and I go, all right, I want at least 75% of the time I want you to come together for a moment between points. And you might go up to your partner and just tell them a stupid joke for a second, or find something to laugh at about the opponents, or say good shot. Or sometimes I like to go up to my partner and go, hey, you know what? Nothing. I came by to say nothing. But they don't know that I've said nothing. They think we said something.
Right.
You know, so, and then that's, you know, because that appearance of being together can be really powerful, especially if the other team's not talking to each other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you take the Bryan brothers for, you know, perfect example. They're always communicating with each other in between points. So, I mean, that's just, it's an image of a team versus two individuals. So.
Exactly. All right. So you got anything else to share with us in terms of bad advice?
Don't listen to it. That's what I tell my players. If it sounds bad, it probably is. So.
Yeah.
It smells like a fish. It looks like a fish. It's probably a fish.
Yeah. Yeah. Around here we say duck, but, you know, that's all right.
Yeah.
So, all right. Hey, thanks for coming on, Chad. And then
No problem, Bill.
Great to hear from you. So we'll catch you on the Facebook page.
All right. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Yep, bye.
All right. Bye. Okay. So, you know, another thing about, you know, bad advice is that there's a lot of it out there. People have a lot of misconceptions that they're perpetuating. And, you know, one of the pieces of bad advice that I see regularly is you must go to an academy, you know. And it's really sad to me when I see that a player has a particular coach that they've been working with and there's a lot of progress going on, and then there's this myth that when you get to a certain level, now you must go to an academy. And really the opposite is true. Probably you can do a much better job of making friends and setting up practice matches and not getting into this big drill and kill thing of you know, I know of some local so-called academies where there's no academic aspect to it whatsoever, and all they really do is give the kids a workout, and there's not even really a lot of match or set or point play in it, just endless hitting of balls. So yeah, folks, you know, stick with the program. Really think through what you're doing and try different things, but then really analyze it and see, is this really helping my game? You know, maybe save yourself some money as well, because some of the academies tend to be pretty expensive. So your weekly private lesson might actually end up being a lot less expensive in the long run. All right. So I'm looking for another caller here. All right. So somebody call in now. All right. So, It's been fun so far, and I'm going to wait here another minute or two for another caller to come in. And if we don't get one, then we'll hang it up. And I'm pretty happy with Debbie and Dewey and Chad for calling in. So that's been a fun thing. You know, I think when it comes to some of the misconceptions, I can go back and read through some of the things that were posted here on this. This was the inspiration for the show. I'll read some off, and if anybody wants to call in and talk about them. All right, so Walter D'Amico said, you can only play good volleys with a continental grip. And I do agree with that too much emphasis is placed on maintaining perfect continental grips, when in reality, really the very best players, when they have time, will make a subtle adjustment to their grip to get their hand in a stronger position, right? I think the best advice that counters that is, when you have time, get your hand in the strongest position that you can create behind the racket. Conversely, there's a guy, local guy here, Henry Kamakana, who talks about the flexibility of gripping, especially on volleys. When he demonstrates hitting a backhand volley using a forehand grip, and then the extreme angle that he can create on that, and also he buys himself time that way. And then also a forehand volley using a backhand grip. So go ahead and try that out and then see if you can hit some balls that went past you. This is something that I do sometimes when somebody's ripping a ball at me, is I can switch and use that other grip. And it really does work quite well. All right. Here's another one. This is from Matt Wright. Don't forget to jump on your serve, right? You know, it is true that if you're swinging with enough force and you're pressing against the ground, you may be lifted off the ground. But sometimes people see that and they think that there was some type of intention to jump, all right? Sean Frazier says, always step forward when hitting your forehand. As we discussed with Dewey there, you know, that's not always possible. Ryan Zeman says, throw the ball to the right when you want to hit a slice serve. Actually, that's a really good giveaway to your opponent that they're going to see what you're doing there. So as much as possible, learn to have the same toss and learn to hit all of your serves with that same toss, and then you are less likely to give away which serve you're hitting at that time. Okay. Walter D'Amico says, you have to stand still when you hit the ball. And that requires a little clarification because, yes, Peter Berwash calls the game, tennis is a game of emergencies. And so, yes, there are some times you have to hit some off-balance shots or you still have to be moving. Whenever possible, though, I look for the still moment. And when you look at the very best players when they're playing, the players who are just on the next rung down, the top players are able to get in position and have a moment where they are still and on balance for just a moment, more than the others. You know, and then conversely, if you're really on the move, if you can at least have 1 foot in contact with the ground while you're swinging forward, then you're going to do a lot better than if you're in full motion of running. So that's a little clarification on that one. But yeah, I mean, sometimes you just can't get yourself set. The game is too fast these days. All right. Another one from Walter, try to hit the ball always at hip height. You know, and that's where individual differences come in. I mean, if you're a certain height and you have a certain gripping style, your ideal contact point is going to be somewhere else. So, you know, don't be a cookie cutter. Don't accept cookie cutter coaching. Don't put yourself into the cookie cutter. Learn your game and where your ideal contact point is, and then work as well as you can to get into that position. You know, not always possible. So, all right. Greg Hearn says, stop hitting off your back foot, right? Which, you know, we covered that also earlier, was that, that, you know, there is a lot of rotating off of the back foot that happens these days because you're forced to because of the heavy topspin, high arcing ball, right? So anyway, we are getting towards the end here. We did hear from a few people, and I thought that the comments were great, and I look forward to maybe doing this again sometime. So thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.